Jerry Spinelli, Newbery Award-winning author of Maniac McGee, Report to the Principal's Office. For their contributions to this book, I would like to thank Pat Carbone, teacher, Judy Anderson, teacher, and Jeannie Singleton, kid. Chapter 1. Sunny Weiler opened her front door and stepped out of her house. Directly across the street, Hillary Kane came out of her house. The instant the two best friends saw each other, they burst into tears. They met on the sidewalk in front of Sunny's house. "Come on," sniffed Hillary. "I'll walk you to the bus." They walked as slowly as they could. "Look at this," said Sunny, picking at the sleeve of her Death to Mushrooms t-shirt. "Same rag I wore last year. I'm going to wear it every day till we're back together again." "Won't you have to get it washed?" "I'm not gonna." "You'll start to smell." "Good," grumbled Sunny. "The worse I smell, the faster they'll kick me out and transfer me to your school." "Now I feel guilty," said Hillary. "Why? Here I am with my new clothes. I should give up more like you." "Don't be a moron," said Sunny. "You know me. I overdo everything." "You're doing the hair? That's enough." "You think so?" "I think so." The girls had vowed that from that day forward, they would never again wash their hair until they were back in the same school. For 7 years, preschool, kindergarten, grades 1 through 5, Sunny and Hillary had gone to the same school. In fact, at Drewmore Elementary, they had always shared the same classroom. They became best friends. They went on vacations with each other's families. And to top it off, they lived directly across the street from each other. They were meant to be together. Nothing would ever break them up. But something did. The two sinister forces were at work during those 7 years. One force was population movement. More and more families were making their homes in Cedar Grove. The other force was babies. People were having more of them than before. Newspapers called it the baby boomlet. Even so, babies alone were not the problem. The problem was, they got older. The problem was, sooner or later, the babies became sixth graders. The problem was, Cedar Grove Middle School could not hold them all. The problem was, they built a new middle school, Plumstead, to hold the growing population. The problem was, when they drew the line on the town map to decide who goes to Cedar Grove and who goes to Plumstead, they drew it smack dab down the middle of the street that Sunny Weiler and Hillary Kane lived on. Hillary would go to the old school, Cedar Grove. Sunny would go to the new one, Plumstead. "I feel like I'm walking to the gallows," said Sunny. "Me too," said Hillary. She fished around for something helpful to say. "Look at the bright side. You're going to a brand new school, new desks, new everything. I hear they even have air conditioning." "I don't want air conditioning," Sunny grumped. "I just want to go to Cedar Grove." And they looked at each other. More tears came, and in the case of Sunny, something else. "Your nose is running," said Hillary. Sunny sniffed. The runner retreated like a turtle's head. "It's the baby boomlet's fault," said Hillary. "It's our parents' fault," said Sunny. "The rats." Hillary nodded. It was true. Their very own parents had been among the worst offenders of the boomlet. Each girl had two younger siblings, Sonny, two brothers, and Hillary, a brother and sister. "We should have stopped them," Sonny said. "We should have put our foot down. No more babies." "Then you wouldn't have any little brothers," Hillary pointed out. A wicked grin curled Sonny's lip. "Yeah, too bad. Little brothers were not Sonny's favorite people." "Ear, nose again," said Hillary. This time, Sunny did not sniff. "Let it run. I'm never going to wipe it. I'm not going to smile. I'm not going to talk. Not even if a teacher asks me a question. They'll be so disgusted with me and my bad attitude and my stinky shirt and my greasy hair, they'll have to transfer me. They'll beg me to go. They'll hire a limo to take me away." If anyone else had said this, Hillary would have cracked up. But she knew her friend was perfectly serious and in no mood to be laughed at. "We're here," said Hillary. Sunny walked on. "I think it's the next corner." If she could only keep walking, she would never be there. It would never happen. "Sunny," called Hillary, "this is the corner." Sunny stopped. She slumped, beaten. A sigh of utter desolation rose from her heart. She returned to Hillary. The two friends stood grimly, silently, by the stop sign. Two blocks away, a yellow bus turned onto the street. Suddenly, Sunny felt emptied of everything else. She grabbed onto Hillary and felt Hillary squeeze back. The bus should have come slowly, creeping, respecting her feelings. Instead, it roared to the curbside and, without the slightest hesitation, flung open its door. "Oh," peeped Sunny. The two friends hugged inches from the yawning door. Sunny did not notice, but Hillary's hug was slightly lopsided. As much as she loved Sunny, Hillary did not care to have her new shirt become a handkerchief for Sunny's runny nose. "Let's go, girls," called the bus driver. "I got a lot of people to pick up." Sunny wasn't surprised at the remark. She had already decided that the Plumstead bus drivers would be despicable gorillas. She parted from Hillary, mounted the steps, and before she could wave to her friend, the door had shut, and the bus was roaring away. "Okay," she thought, "one final word before I shut up forever." She paused beside the bus driver. Sure enough, there was hair growing out of his ears. "Gorilla," she said, and walked down the aisle. Chapter 2. Eddie Mott watched the girl come down the aisle with a growing dread. The seat next to him was empty. He had been hoping it would be filled by someone friendly and talkative, someone who would help take his mind off the fact that this was his first day of middle school, but the girl looked anything but friendly. He had seen her glare at the bus driver and say something to him. Now, as she came nearer, he got a full view of the scowl on her face. It was worse than anything he had ever seen on a TV wrestler. And then he spotted the gleam under her left nostril. "This girl's got problems," he thought. "Please don't let her sit here." But sit there she did, plopped herself right down next to him, scowling straight ahead. Up till now, things had gone about as well as could be expected. Eddie had been determined to break the bonds of little boyhood and take that first big step into a more grown-up world. Every school day for 5 years, his mother had walked him to Brockhurst Elementary. But last night, he had said, "Mom, I want to walk to the bus myself." And he had. He had picked out his own clothes to wear. Middle school clothes, the Daffy Duck pin that he had worn every day last year lay back on his bedroom dresser. Leaving his memories behind was not so easy. At just about this time in the morning every day last year, he and Roger Himes would be raising the American flag outside Brockhurst. That had been his job all through fifth grade. But now, he was a sixth grader, and doggone it, he was going to fit in. That's why he had made up a three-point plan. 1, be friendly. 2, wear the right clothes. 3, avoid eighth graders. The last point was advice from Roger Himes, whose older brother was now entering high school. "Stay away from eighth graders," warned Roger. "They'll get you into trouble. They run the school." Things had been going well until the sourpussed girl plopped down beside him. Now he began to feel his control of the situation slipping away. All morning, he had been wearing an especially friendly face. If only she would turn and see how friendly he was. "Hi," he said. The girl didn't move an inch. She continued to stare glumly at the back of the seat in front of her. Maybe she has a hearing problem, he thought. He couldn't see a hearing aid. Maybe it was the ear on the side away from him. So this time he tapped her lightly on the wrist when he said, "Hi." Still, she didn't move. Was she hypnotized? In a trance? The half of her face that he could see was the side with a running nostril. Actually, it wasn't running at all. It was simply sitting there, a gleaming little puddle as though it had just crept out to have a look around. And it was really starting to bother him, Eddie being a very neat kid. It was all he could do to keep from whipping out his hanky and wiping it away. Maybe if he brought it to her attention in a nice way. "Got a cold there?" he said as pleasantly as possible. Slowly the girl's head turned. He had never seen a head turn so slowly till she was fully facing him. He froze. She raised her upper lip till she looked like a snarling Doberman. She sniffed. The gleamer, zipped back into her nose. She turned away. Eddie had allowed himself a breath. Now that the first move was over, he decided it hadn't really been so bad. After all, she did turn. She did respond to him. Must have been his friendly face. Maybe he should say something a little meatier this time. "I hear the new school has air conditioning," he said. Again, the head slowly turned. The girl spoke. "The next person that tells me the new school has air conditioning is going to get a punch in the face." For the rest of the ride, Eddie looked out the window. When the bus arrived at school, Eddie made sure to let the grump get well ahead of him. It was slow going down the aisle as the bus had been filled to the gills. Eddie was scrunched front and back. He held his lunch bag to his chest. Everybody towered over him. There was a commotion up front, bringing the aisle to a standstill. Kids up front were yelling to kids in back, all eighth graders, no doubt. The kids up front were calling for their football. The kids in the back were saying they didn't have it. The kids up front said they weren't getting off till they got it. The bus driver was calling them all delinquents and telling them to get off his bus. He had a job to do. "Throw the ball," yelled the guys up front. "Okay," yelled the guys behind. "You asked for it." And suddenly, Eddie was off his feet, hands under him from ankles to shoulders. He was horizontal, on his back, staring straight up at the white ceiling of the bus. "Here," yelled the voices below him, and he was flying down the aisle, above the aisle, clutching his lunch bag, landing in a squirmy bed of hands. "Hey," yelled the new voices, "this isn't our ball." And he was flying back down the aisle. At that point, the bus driver went totally wacko and started tossing kids off the bus. When Eddie came to his senses, he found himself alone on the back seat. Chapter 3. T. Charles Brimlow was as ready as he would ever be. 15 minutes before the first bus arrived, he was out front wearing a smile as wide as his bow tie. And why not? He was a brand new principal and a brand new school. Talk about a fresh start. And he was determined to make the most of it. The town, the architects, the taxpayers, they had given him all any principal could ask for in the way of a facility. The most modern this, the most up-to-date that, high-tech electronics from boiler room to kitchen. But without people, it was just a brick and glass skeleton. Students, teachers, staff, they would bring it to life, give it heart and soul. And it was he, T. Charles Brimlow, more than any other person who would determine the quality, the character of that heart and soul. He could only be successful, he had decided, if he and the students worked together as a team. Or even better, as a family. That was the key word, family. He intended to keep that word constantly in mind as he guided those 340 kids through their 3 years at Plumstead. That was the key word, family. He intended to keep that word constantly in mind as he guided these 340 kids through their 3 years at Plumstead. All summer long, Mr. Brimlow had studied their records and profiles and pictures so that now, beaming as the buses began to arrive, he felt as if he already knew them. It was a stitch watching the surprise on the kids' faces as he held out his hand and greeted many of them by name. "Good morning, Jennifer. Welcome to Plumstead." "Hiya, Robert. You look like you've gained weight over the summer." "Morning, Claudia. Still want to be a pilot?" Now, here was a dark-haired girl he couldn't place. Of course, that might be because her face was contorted into one of the most miserable frowns he had ever seen. He felt an instant need to make this child happy. "Hello there," he said cheerfully. "I'm Mr. Brimlow. What's your name?" "Butthead," replied the girl, and breezed on past. By the time Mr. Brimlow recovered, the girl was long gone and another stood in front of him. This one had long, curly hair, a thin, interesting face, and large eyes that seemed on the verge of astonishment. Slung over her shoulder was a green book bag. Her name was about to come to him, but she was the first to speak. "You're Mr. Brimlow, aren't you?" "I am," he said, still somewhat dazed by the first girl. "The principal? So they tell me." She smiled broadly and thrust out her hand. "Nice to meet you. I'm Salem Brownmiller." He shook her hand, Salem Jane Brown Miller, to be exact. Her wide eyes widened. "You know me? I know your school profile." She sagged a trifle. "Oh, then perked up again. So you know I'm a writer. Indeed I do. You won the story contest at Hillmont last year. She beamed. I won a gold pin. The story was called The Squirrels of Pauline. It's about this fifth grade girl and two baby squirrels she meets when lightning strikes a tree in the playground and they fall from their nest. Would you like to read it? I certainly would, replied the principal. In a flash, the girl whipped out some stapled sheets from her book bag and thrust them into his hand. I carry copies of my stories everywhere I go. You never know when somebody might ask for one. Or suppose my house burns down with all my manuscripts in it. Mr. Brimlow was considering the horror of it when a short, portly man with hair in his ears tapped him on the shoulder. You the bus monitor? No, I'm the principal. Can I help you? Yeah, said the portly man. I got a kid here. Won't get off my bus. Chapter 4. The mashed stump of a cigar moved about the mouth of the portly, hairy-eared man as though it had a life of its own. I could drag the kid off, he went on, but I don't need to get sued. I already put my hands on enough of them. In 10 minutes, I gotta be at the gas station. This ain't my only job, Chief. Mr. Brimlow nodded. Lead the way. Salem Brownmiller tugged on his sleeve. Oh, Mr. Brimlow, can I come too? I'm writing a story about a girl's first day in middle school, and this could make a really neat subplot. The principal faced her sternly. Miss Brownmiller, whoever that is in the bus, is a person, not a subplot. For once, the girl was slow to speak. Those wide eyes stared up at him. I didn't mean it that way, Mr. Brimlow. The principal softened. All right, keep your distance and don't interfere. The boy was in the back seat of the bus. His head was slightly atilt. A brown lunch bag rested on his lap, held by both hands. The toes of his new sneakers pointed towards each other. They did not reach the floor. The principal walked halfway down the aisle and stopped. The boy seemed to be staring at a point in space, about a foot in front of his own face. Mr. Brimlow remembered the face. Brockhurst. Edward, he said gently. In the background, the first bell rang. Students yelped, streamed past the bus windows. Edward Mott? No response. Brockhurst? Flagboy? Edward Mott's head remained still, but his eyes rolled upwards. I'm Mr. Brimlow, your new principal, he sat on the edge of his seat. Would you like to come up here and sit with me? No answer. The principal moved one seat closer. You know, Edward, do your friends call you Eddie? The boy shrugged. You know, Eddie, we have something in common, you and I. Can you guess what it is? Eddie Mott shrugged. Well, I'll tell you. This is your first day as a sixth grader, and this is my first day as principal. How about that? The answer came from the front of the bus. I don't get out of here. This is my last day at the station. There's a mechanic down there, can't work on cars because he's got to pump gas because I ain't there to pump gas. Mr. Brimlow stood. He clapped his hands. Okay, Eddie, what do you say? Ready to go? Eddie Mott finally spoke. No. That does it, growled the driver. The door swung shut. The engine rumbled to life. The bus lurched down the driveway. Hey, said Principal Brimlow. We're being hijacked, piped Salem Brownmiller, not unhappily. The bus roared right on past the school bus parking lot and did not stop until it humped up to the restroom of the Texaco station on the corner of Grant and Mud. The driver flipped his hands as he jumped off. You want to fire me? Fire me. It was now 8:10 a.m., 10 minutes into the first period of the first day at Plumstead Middle School, and a lot of people didn't know where a lot of things were. The gym teachers couldn't find a football, the geography teacher couldn't find a map, and the math teachers had no chalk, and no one knew where the principal was. Mrs. Wilburham, the school secretary, was going batty. People were calling her on the brand new high-tech state-of-the-art intercom system, but darn if she could figure out how to answer them. She flipped switches all over the fancy console, but the best she could do was connect the kitchen to the teacher's lounge. The office was getting more and more crowded. Teachers, students, everyone had a problem or a question for her, as if she were the answer lady. She didn't even know how to work this newfangled telephone with its million buttons and lights. If she did, she'd be calling the police right now to report a missing principal. First period was nearly over. The German teacher was trying to figure out the intercom. The nurse was studying the telephone, and the entire history department was at the counter asking for books, when in strolled the principal himself, along with a boy and a girl, and taking their sweet old time about it, too. Laughing, jabbering, couldn't care less that the school was falling down around the secretary's ears. "You're late," said Mrs. Wilbraham, not even trying to disguise her displeasure. The principal pretended to be shocked. "We are?" He looked down at his accomplices. "Well," he shrugged, "I guess we'll all have to go to the late room." The three of them broke up laughing and then looked up the kids' schedules, scribbled out a late note for each, and sent them on their way, but not before shaking hands with them and saying, with a wink, "See you at lunch." Mrs. Wilbraham bit her tongue. She had trained 5 principals in her lifetime. Apparently, this one was going to take some doing. She had to admit, though, once he decided to show up, things did get done. Within 5 minutes, the gym people got their footballs, the geography teacher her map, the mathematicians their chalk, the history department its books. He showed her how to get an outside line on the telephone, and he played the intercom console like Liberace at the piano. There were only 5 minutes left of the first period when he flipped the toggle labeled All Receivers and made his opening remarks to the school. "Good morning, everyone. I apologize to you all for not speaking to you during homeroom. I had some pressing business elsewhere. Let me make it plain that this is not my official greeting. That will come in a couple of weeks when we have our opening assembly in the new auditorium. That's when all of us will meet all of you, and when we will learn the identity of our school mascot, the selection of which you will be involved in. In the meantime, let's you and I and Plumstead get to know each other. Over the last couple of years, we've all felt a little like orphans now and then, haven't we? Not enough seats, not enough classrooms, shifting school boundaries. We were never really sure where we belonged, were we? Well, I'm here to tell you that it's all over. I'm here to tell you now that we have our own place, our own house. I'm here to say, welcome home." The principal flipped the toggle off, laid down the mic, and went into his office. Someone was there.